I'm going to talk about the developments in relation to well, jurisprudence of the court on rights of third country nationals who are in one way or another linked to EU migrating citizens or not migrating citizens. So are we not talking about asylum, immigration, refugee case law, which is extremely prolific for obvious reasons? But Carolina asked me to link the free movement with third country nationals. And I've picked four judgments to demonstrate pretty much what has happened in the last few years. And I should add that this case law is even now more important because it applies to UK citizens who will move or have moved in the last 20 or 30 few days and will move in the future because they are proper third country nationals and the new Trade and Cooperation Agreement does not deal with migration at all on the insistence of the British government. I should emphasize that the UK citizens who have exercised their free movement rights by the 31st of December last year, so 2020, they are covered by the withdrawal agreement. So their status is comparable to EU migrating citizens. They have all the rights written down in the withdrawal agreement. And those provisions in part two of the withdrawal agreement are pretty much copy-pasted from Directive 2004/38 and expanded a little bit, especially in terms of the procedural rules. I should also add that the withdrawal agreement, as per its own provisions, is directly effective. So the assumption is that the provisions are clear, precise, and unconditional, and therefore can be invoked by UK nationals in courts of member states. I expect a lot of case law based on the withdrawal agreement, not only in the UK but also in the European Union. There's quite a few problematic areas there. I'll be happy to discuss it, of course, should you wish so, when we have the time for questions and answers. I understand, Karina, that I'm now speaking for half an hour, then we have a short break for questions, and then I have another half an hour. And do control me. You know that I can speak forever, unfortunately, for some. Right. So I shall start with a brief recap. What we're really talking about here is Directive 2004/38, which normally applies to EU citizens migrating between the member states. And it also applies to their family members. And it applies to family members irrespective of their nationality. So they don't have to be EU citizens. They can be third country nationals. And in the majority of cases, statistically, if you have families moving across the borders, people usually apply for res or sort of acquire residence rights in their own right. So if it's two spouses, they try to reside in their own right, not to be chained to one another. But should that not be possible, the family members may derive the rights from the primary right holder, be it another spouse or more obvious cases, children or elderly parents, for instance. Now, there's a few provisions which are very important, which I will refer to today in the judgments that I prepared for you. The first to deal with the definition of family member. Now, we have two rules here. One laid down in Article 2, Paragraph 2 of the directive, which gives automatic right of residence and right to be employed to the closest family listed there. Now, as far as extended family is concerned, so going beyond spouses, children, ascendants, descendants, we have so-called extended family members. And their rights are not as strong as of the closest family. Now, this is laid down in Article 3, Paragraph 2 of the directive. Why do I say that the rights are not as strong? Simply because the immigration authorities have a bit of discretion. So the right to reside for a family member, therefore, is not 100% automatic. The first judgment, which I will be talking about, deals precisely with that issue. Who is the immediate family member? Who is the extended family member? And what kind of discretion the immigration authorities have? Now, the other part of the directive, which is very important, Articles 9 to 15, they deal with various administrative requirements, and also retention of rights. So should, for instance, migrating EU citizen from whom the other person derives the right, should that primary right holder sadly pass away, for instance? Or should there be a case of a divorce or departure of the primary right holder? And what happens then? Now, the case which I will tell you about slipped through the net of Articles 12 and 13. So we had a woman who was a non-EU national. The husband departed, not because he wanted to do so. I will explain that later. And then the retention provisions did not apply to this lady. And there was a question whether she could be deported or not, and if so, on what grounds. And very important provisions dealing with permanent right of residence, and finally restrictions to free movement rights, Articles 27 onwards. Now, of course, it's a directive, so what matters for you is what you have in your national legal systems in terms of the implementation measures. And I will give you an example from the case law where a member state, Spain, in this particular case, extended some of those provisions actually to its own citizens and the family reunification. There is one document which is also relevant, which is European Commission guidance on interpretation of Directive 2004/38. Now, that is, of course, just guidance, which means it's non-binding. And as you will see on the first example from the jurisprudence, the court did not actually agree with some of the points that the Commission made. So we need to treat that guidance with a bit of caution. So that's by the way of introduction. The first judgment I would like to talk about is called SM. For obvious reasons, once you hear the fact, and the reasons will be obvious, the plaintiff has been anonymized. Now, this was a reference from the UK's Supreme Court submitted in 2018, so UK was already on the way out, but obviously at that stage it was a fully fledged member state still, therefore the Supreme Court had full unlimited right or obligation in a way to send a reference for preliminary ruling. As far as the Court of Justice was concerned, the case was handled by the Grand Chamber of the court, so of course it is a very important judgment, and the Advocate General was the Spanish Advocate General Sanchez Bordona. Now, the facts of the case were as follows. So SM is a child. She was born in Algeria in 2010. And she was abandoned by her biological parents. Now, Mr. M and Mrs. M, a French couple who was residing in the United Kingdom, decided to adopt the child. And for that purpose, they travelled to Algeria. The problem was that, well, to adopt a non-EU child in the United Kingdom is a procedural nightmare, so they opted for an easier solution, which would be adoption in Algeria. The problem, though, is that Algeria does not recognise adoption as such. However, Algerian law follows something called kafala system, which is a form of guardianship, which is based on the Islam principles. Now, kafala is different to what we would understand in the European Union as adoption. First of all, it is time limited. It's only applicable until a child becomes an adult. Furthermore, the child cannot become an heir to the adopted parents. Now, what happened in Algeria? Everything went fine, and Mr. and Mrs. M undertook the oath to give, and I quote, an Islamic education to the child, to keep her fit morally and physically, supplying her needs, looking after the teaching, treating her like natural parents, protect, defend her before judicial instances, and assume civil liability for detrimental acts. And then the child formally had her name changed to Mr. and Mrs. M's family name. And now the real problem starts. as you can guess, this story is heading to UK immigration authorities, because obviously the two, being French nationals residing legally in the United Kingdom, they're EU migrating citizens, and therefore they want to bring the child to the United Kingdom. And the problem is whether the child qualifies for the automatic right of residence as a descendant, or the child qualifies as an extended family members. So the question, legal question, is whether kafala is comparable to adoption, and therefore, from the legal point of view, that baby can be considered as a child of Mr. and Mrs. M. Now, let me quote relevant provisions of the directive, and this will then make more sense. Article 2, paragraph 2 of the directive provides us with the definition of family member. Apart from spouses, which is obvious, we have direct descendants who are under the age of 21, or are dependents and those of the spouse or partner as defined in paragraph 2. And should the child fall into this category, then it has, of course, the right to reside, which is automatic. Now, as far as extended family members, the directive in Article 3, paragraph 2 provides that without prejudice to any rights to free movement and residence, the person concerned may have in their own right, the host member state shall, in accordance with its national legislation, watch out, facilitate entry and residence for the following persons: any other family members, irrespective of their nationality, who do not fall under the definition in Article 2.2, where we have this list of family members, who are dependents or members of the household of the union citizen having the primary right of residence. So on the one hand, the family members like that potentially have the right to reside that they would derive from the primary right holder. However, the member states do not have the obligation to give it automatically. So the directive says member states shall facilitate entry. So therefore, a lot depends on the friendliness of the immigration authorities. And as you probably have heard, the Home Office, the British immigration authorities, are not terribly known for being kind to foreigners, especially in the last few years. It's actually quite the opposite. So it was of vital importance whether that baby could be the child or extended family member. Now, the Commission's, this is of course not regulated, there's no definition of a child, of descendant, in the directive. However, it's been accepted that child is understood to be a biological child of the parents, or a child that is formally adopted within the meaning of the law of the host member state. But the question was whether in the United Kingdom kafala could qualify as the adoption, and the answer was no. And this is where we see where the court and the Commission diverge, because the Commission, in its communication on the application and transposition of the directive, says that descendant includes minors in custody of a permanent legal guardian, end of quote. And that would be broad enough to accommodate kafala. However, the court disagreed. The court says descendant is only the child who is either a biological child or formally adopted in accordance with the law of the host member state. Therefore, it is clear that under the circumstances, the child could not derive the automatic right to reside from her parents, well, kafala parents, but she fell potentially under 3 paragraph 2, giving discretion to the Home Office. The Court of Justice here says, well, the discretion must be exercised in the light of the Charter of Fundamental Rights. The court says, well, this is a clear case where the Charter applies. This constitutes implementation of EU law, Article 51 of the Charter, or that falls within the scope of application of the Charter as the court defined that in the Ackerberg-Franson case. So the court says, well, first of all, the immigration authorities should take into account the right to respect for private and family life, which is laid down in Article 7 of the Charter, and also it should take into account the rights of children. The best interests of the child should be taken into account. This is guaranteed in Article 24, paragraph 2 of the Charter of Fundamental Rights. So the court says the authorities need to make, and I quote, a balanced and reasonable assessment of all the current and relevant circumstances of the case, taking account of all the interests in play, and in particular, the best interests of the child concerned. And that has to take into account, for instance, the age at which the child was placed under the kafala system. This was a toddler, basically. Whether the child has lived with its guardian since the placement under kafala system, the closeness of the personal relationship which the child has developed with the parents and the guardians, and the extent to which the child is dependent on them. Well, as a toddler, it's 100% dependent, obviously. And also, it should take into account whether the two people, Mr. and Mrs. M, in this particular case, assume parental responsibility for real, and take the legal and financial responsibility for the child. Now, what was the concern of the immigration authorities in the United Kingdom was whether various risks were to be taken into account, for instance, potential trafficking of children, etc. And the court says, yes, of course, this should be taken into account. This is part of the assessment, but nothing in the case file suggested that the child was trafficked into the United Kingdom or subject to any illegal activity of whatever form. So the conclusion from the judgment was that indeed a child which was put under guardianship under the kafala system would not qualify as a direct descendant, so would not fall under the automatic right to reside derived from parents laid down in Article 2.2 of the directive, but fell under the category of extended family member. However, looking at all the benchmarks that the court laid down for the immigration authorities, they were in fact left with very little discretion as to whether to give that child the right to reside in the United Kingdom or not. So that's the first judgment which I had for you. The second one is an Irish case, this time, Nalini Chinchilia against Minister for Justice and Equality. So what were the facts of the case? As I said, High Court of Ireland sent a reference. Again, it's a Grant Chamber case. At the Court of Justice, the Advocate General is Maciej Punar, the first Advocate General at the court, the Polish Advocate General. Now, what about the facts? Well, the plaintiff is from Mauritius, and she arrived in Ireland. I'll give you a few dates because that gives the big picture. She arrived in Ireland in 2005, so quite a while ago. She had a student visa, and she resided legally in Ireland until 7th of February 2012. So she's been there legally as a student for 7 years. And she got successive permissions to remain. But in 2001, as it happens, she fell in love with a Portuguese chap who was living in Ireland. And a few months after they got married, she applied for a residence card, but not in her own right as a citizen of Mauritius, but as a spouse of an EU migrating citizens. So she tried to trigger her rights to reside under Directive 2004/38. Now, the dates are important. So she applied for that on the 2nd February 2012, which was 5 days before her student visa was about to expire. That's quite silly to wait that long, apart from anything else. As it turned out, her husband was sort of freshly in Ireland. He didn't live in Ireland for long. So during the first 3 months of his residence in Ireland, he met the criteria for residence, and there are none. I mean, under the directive, for the first 3 months, you can reside without any requirement being complied with. The trouble starts under the directive if you are for longer than 3 months and under 5 years. Because then, in order to reside under the directive, you need to either be a worker or self-employed, or you need to meet the criteria for the general right of residence, meaning you need to have financial resources. You cannot be burdened to the social protection system, so you cannot run to the equivalent of the UK's job centre and claim benefits. And the third condition is you need to have a comprehensive health insurance. So the immigration authorities in Ireland started to make inquiries, checking what the husband was up to, because he was already for over 3 months in Ireland. So they wanted to have evidence that he was a worker, self-employed, or simply had financial resources. Now, she did not, in October of 2012, Mrs. Chanchalia provided evidence that he started to work in a restaurant and that he has worked at that stage for 2 weeks. And she asked for extension of the deadline for him to work a bit longer so that her application can be processed in a positive fashion. And then she disappeared, at least from the radars of the immigration authorities. She popped up again 2 years later and asked for permission to reside on the basis of her personal circumstances. So what has happened in the meantime? Well, her husband departed back to Portugal. But as I mentioned earlier on, he did not do that on his own volition. He committed a crime, it's turned out. So he was a naughty boy, and he was basically in Portugal in jail while the departed spouse was in Ireland. So at this stage, she was no longer fighting to have the right to reside, because, as I will explain in a few minutes, that was simply not available to her under the terms of Directive 2004/38. However, she was fighting, because of course the Irish authorities wanted to deport her, she was fighting to have the deportation administered in accordance with Directive 2004/38, not the Irish law applicable to third country nationals. What's the difference? Well, what the Irish authorities wanted to do was to deport her under Irish provisions dealing with deportation of third country nationals, which would allow them to impose an indefinite ban to come back to the country. While this is not available if you are deported under the directive, there may be some sort of time restriction before you can come back, but it cannot be a definite ban. Plus, as she claimed, it's not so easy to deport people under Directive 2004/38, because there are various procedural safeguards that need to be complied with, which are laid down in Articles 27 onwards. So, not surprisingly, with such complicated facts and potential legal regimes governing her status, the Irish High Court sent a reference for preliminary ruling. The question was basically whether she was the beneficiary of the directive within the meaning of Article 3, Paragraph 1 of the directive, and which rules should apply to her deportation. Now, as it turned out, as I said, she was no longer the beneficiary of the directive. And that's for a number of reasons. First of all, because the primary right holder was gone. And apart from anything else, at some point when he was still in Ireland, this was not in compliance with the directive, because he was at that material time after 3 months. He did not meet any conditions laid down in the directive to reside lawfully. And now he was out of the equation. Now, what is interesting is that you have two provisions in the directive which deals with retained rights of family members. That's Article 12 of the directive, which applies to retention in case of death or departure of the EU citizen, and Article 13, retention in the event of divorce, annulment of the marriage, or termination of the registered partnership. Well, 13, of course, didn't apply. They were not divorced. And the trouble with the departure is that, as you will see, the provisions are very carefully crafted, giving very few rights to spouses who are third country nationals. So she did not fall under any of those rules, and therefore there was no protection. Her rights could not be protected under the directive. However, as you know, in EU law, there's a rule, then there's a comma, and then there is however. So however, there was the question of the rules that would apply to her deportation. Article 15 of the directive was relevant here. It says that some of the procedural rules which are laid down in Article 31 and 30 of the directive, some procedural guarantees, they apply by analogy to all decisions restricting movement of EU citizens and their family members. And this applies to cases where people are not deported on grounds of public security, public policy, or public health, which is regulated in Articles 27 and 28. She was not being deported on any of those grounds. She was deported because she no longer simply had the derived right to reside in Ireland. Crucially, Article 15, paragraph 3, says that the host member state, if someone is deported under Article 15, may not, and I quote, impose a ban on entry in the context of an expulsion decision to which paragraph 1 applies. So the question was whether she could rely on that. And the Court of Justice said absolutely so. She could not apply on Articles 27 and 28, where all the procedural guarantees are there, because she was not being deported on grounds of public policy, public security, and or public health. But the court says the procedural rules, which are in Article 30 or 31, to which 15 cross refers, they need to be applied to her case. And bonus, again, this falls within the notion of implementation of EU law. Therefore, the Charter of Fundamental Rights applies, which means that, for instance, she benefits from the right to an effective remedy under Article 47 of the Charter, plus the decision to deport must be proportionate. So, to put it differently, the authorities should take, for instance, into account that she has resided by then in Ireland for almost 10 years, which is quite a big portion of her life, and we assume she is quite young. She has been studying there for quite a while. So the conclusion of the court, you have a quote here from the Advocate General Sharpstone. The conclusion of the court was that Article 15 applies, the procedural safeguards in Articles 30-31 apply mutatis mutandis, and the Charter of Fundamental Rights applies here as well, including the right to an effective remedy.